It's just 2 days until the Thanksgiving holiday. Here's a little peek at what's happening in my head. Okay, all right, lots to do. His parents are driving up. Okay, they get here at 7. Let me start just by getting these sheets in the washing machine. Hello? Hey, kiddo. Oh, you're a vegan this year? No problem. We'll still have turkey, but how about quinoa and squash, too? Okay, great. Hey, no, look, before you go, did you get your booster shot yet? Did I send a Lyft to pick my niece up at the airport? Let me check. And I better send her a text. Just a reminder that if the driver isn't wearing a mask, don't even get in that car. Okay, back to the pie.
Ah, dang! Is this food processor not working?
Okay, I'm just gonna mash these sweet potatoes by hand. Okay, washer done. Let me go get these sheets in the dryer. One more check on the Google Doc. Gotta make sure I got all the ingredients. Wait, am I doing too much by having a Google Doc? No, I gotta have it. How else can I be sure I haven't forgotten anything? Oh, yeah, let me get that butter out this often. Wait a minute, one more quick text. What's up, big bro? I know you haven't had the second vaccine dose. It's not the same, but don't worry. I'll send you a Zoom link so we can talk while I'm cooking. Yeah, I know. It's a lot. To be clear, I love the holidays. I've got a supportive family and enough resources to get food on the table. And still, more than I'd like to admit, I'll notice my breathing is short, shallow. My cheek is sore from biting the inside, and my shoulders are so high, they're practically touching my earlobes. One part family stress plus one part pandemic panic can be a recipe for seasonal sadness. You're feeling me, right? So we asked you about how the holidays affect your mental health, especially in the second year of COVID.
Hi, my name is Beth from Glenside, Pennsylvania. This Thanksgiving is a really big anxiety inducer this year. Part of our extended family is unvaccinated, and they're living like it's 2019, no masking, no limiting of where they're going. And so it's up to my nuclear family whether to create a big rift by not seeing them on Thanksgiving, or to take the health risk to maintain good family relations.
The holiday season makes me want to crawl under a rock and hide until January 2nd. My mental health declines sharply and never makes a full rebound come springtime. The pandemic has made everything worse.
Hi, this is Lori from Katona. Mental health during the holidays is challenging for me, especially as an introvert. I find myself really craving quiet, solitude, especially after being around family and friends for long periods of time.
Thanks to all of you who shared how you're feeling during the holidays with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today we're starting with some helpful guidance on mental health this holiday season with Dr. Vail Wright, Senior Director of Healthcare Innovation at the American Psychological Association. Welcome, Dr. Wright.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
What are the kinds of mental health challenges that tend to be exacerbated by the holidays?
Well, certainly one of the most common things would be stress, that everybody does tendency to feel a little bit of stress as the holidays approach, whether that's because you're wanting everything to be perfect or you know you're going to have to engage with family and that causes stress. So anytime stress is increased, then the chances of that being unmanaged could lead to things like depression, isolation, loneliness, anxiety. So that's the kinds of things we get concerned about.
All right. Talk to me a little bit about stress versus issues like depression. Now, clearly they're linked, but I guess part of what I'm wondering is if you already have a diagnosed case of depression and you're treating it with, maybe behavioral practices, medication, therapy, are there proactive ways to enter into the holiday season?
Yeah, absolutely. You want to make sure that, you have kind of your coping plan in place so that when you start to feel stressed, when you start to feel more sad or less connected, that you have ways to shore that back up. So that might be engaging in some self-soothing activities. It could be reaching out to a friend, even when it's hard. It could be having that friend on standby who, if they haven't heard from you in a couple of days, knows to reach out to you instead because your depression may be getting worse. But it's really entering into the holidays with a plan ahead of time so that when you start to struggle, you don't have to try to figure it out. It's already in place.
Now, when you talk about entering in with a plan, clearly the pandemic has disrupted so many kinds of plans. There are probably more opportunities for gathering this year, but we are still very much in a situation where I know, at least in my family, we're still trying to take steps and measures to protect the most vulnerable among us. How does kind of a second holiday season in the context of COVID-19, for whom might these be the most difficult days?
We are seeing a slightly different holiday season compared to last year, but there's still so much uncertainty, and clearly the pandemic has not gone away. So I think for families, it's going to really depend on your own individual circumstances. If you have people in your family that you know are more vulnerable because of medical conditions, maybe you have children who still aren't able to get vaccinated, or there's still a lot of individuals who haven't been vaccinated for one reason or another. And so I think those are the kinds of groups that are most likely to be vulnerable this type of year to the stress, and how to figure out how do you make decisions when there's still so much uncertainty.
Is there any way to have an actual happy Thanksgiving over Zoom?
I think that there is, if you can approach it with the expectation that it's not going to be a real replacement for face-to-face individual time, but instead trying to make it more fun, more active, not just sitting there having a conversation about Thanksgiving or saying hi to each other, but actually maybe playing a game, doing something that's really more interactive and fun, time limited, I think is still better than nothing.
I'm wondering about substance abuse, and I don't know that we always put this under the category of mental health, at least when we're talking about the seasonal stress. But, for many people, having, alcohol on the table is kind of part of the holiday season. But there are often those in our gatherings for whom alcohol is also a very real challenge. I'm wondering the ways to address and to be kind to and to assist and support those in our communities who are who may be gathering with us, but also might be struggling with substance abuse.
Yeah, I think we really need to be entering these conversations with a lot of grace and empathy, and really trying to put ourselves in other people's shoes right now so that we can approach it in a collaborative way. So if you have family members that are struggling, conversations need to be had ahead of time about what makes people comfortable. If having alcohol on the table, for example, is triggering, then maybe have it someplace else, somewhere away where that individual won't have to confront it so in their face. But again, I think it's about planning ahead. It's about having really honest conversations and then doing everything we can to support our loved ones.
Let's talk about young people and adolescent and children's concerns. We've seen such a rise in a variety of mental health diagnoses and concerns for young people, particularly as we've kind of re-entered this school year. And yet we expect kids to always be happy and sometimes also to kind of take a back seat, right? Give up your bed for grandma who's coming to visit, sit at the kids' table, not at the grown-up table. I'm wondering if there are also particular ways that we can support adolescents and teens and other young people in our lives.
Yeah, teens and young adults really need, and children need, routine. Routine helps kind of shore up their emotional well-being. It helps give them a plan. Things feel less uncertain. So to the extent to which we can continue having, those types of routines in place are really going to help kids out. And then we need to make sure we're talking to them. We need to be engaging them in conversations and modeling really strong behaviors for them. So we can be talking about the ways in which we have challenges, whether it's at work or maybe with a family member, and then how we might manage it. And then that helps kids understand that it's okay to not always feel great, but that there are also ways in which you can make yourself feel better if you really work at it.
I'm wondering, short of maybe something that is diagnosable, right? Just if you have suggestions for how we think about kind of setting the limits we need to set to protect ourselves from difficult or challenging family members, while at the same time not having to spend the holidays alone and isolated.
Yeah, I think it's really important for people to, at first, just give yourself permission to even have these boundaries. I think a lot of times we have unrealistic expectations about our family, that somehow we're supposed to get along with family 100% of the time because we're blood related. And the reality is, family are just a group of people like everybody else. So allowing yourself permission to sort of set those boundaries and then enforcing them becomes really critical. And then sometimes it's about sort of having like an escape plan too. So if things start to get too stressful, if things start to get too overwhelming, can you remove yourself even briefly? Can you take a walk around the block? Can you say that, you know, you're not going to stay longer than, you know, a couple hours? Again, setting those boundaries, both the emotional ones, but also the physical ones, are going to, I think, be the key to really having a successful holiday season.
I'm wondering if there are, you know, even for our own like physiology, are there signs we should look for, like, uh-oh, you know, I'm about to erupt in anger, or I'm about to, you know, dissolve into tears over this cranberry sauce? What are some of the ways that if we're not at our best, not the best rested and most hydrated, that we can just sort of monitor our own holiday stress and maybe sadness?
I think for a lot of people, stress and sadness and emotional distress is felt physically first. So that can look like muscle tension, headaches, teeth grinding, or sort of, you know, like just that tension that people do in their shoulders. I mean, even right now, I think people probably listening could probably drop their shoulders away from their ears just to feel that sense of release. And so once you can kind of start paying attention to that, those physical symptoms, because that's your body really trying to wake you up and tell you, hey, something's not right. And then hopefully from there, you can identify, so what are some of the things I can do to help me feel better? Again, do I need to take a walk? Do I need to call a friend? What can I do to regain some of that emotional well-being and stay grounded?
You know, we've been talking a little bit about the stress of sitting down for dinner, but what about the stress of feeling like you can't put dinner on the table, or, you know, you can't partake in the post-Thanksgiving holiday shopping that begins? Ways to maybe think about the kind of self-talk we could be having with ourselves when our financial situations are difficult.
Yeah, that's a real challenging one too. I mean, there are just some real realities for individuals that they're financially struggling, maybe even before the pandemic, but certainly now with the pandemic, given job losses and the rest. I think it's about trying to go back to remembering what we value. And what is it that we value during the holidays? Is it something commercial? Is it having the newest, shiniest thing? Or is it connection? Is it connecting with family, connecting with our spirituality, whatever those values are, and then really focusing on that so that we're taking it away less from, you know, what I have and what I don't have, you know, in terms of like tangible things, but what is it that I really value? How can I prioritize that in an important way that maybe hopefully doesn't cost anything?
And very last question, there's stress, there's anxiety, there's depression, but there can also be happiness and joy. Any thoughts for those who have every expectation of having a happy holiday season, but maybe want to still manage expectations so that even in our happiness, we don't feel disappointment?
Yeah, I know we've been focusing a lot on the holiday stress, but really the holidays are a happy time of year for most people. And it is about going in with the right expectation. And again, I think really focusing on what you value. So going in with the expectation that everything's going to be perfect is going to be very disappointing. So making sure you're going in recognizing that, you know, you might burn a meal here, you might say the wrong thing here. It's all going to be okay as long at the end of the day, you know, we're connecting, we're staying true to ourselves, staying true to our family, and remembering that, you know, this is the time of year to come together and to be grateful for what we do have.
Thanks so much, Dr. Vail Wright, Senior Director of Healthcare Innovation at the American Psychological Association. We appreciate you stopping by, and we hope you have a happy and joyous and healthy holiday season as well.
Oh, thanks so much. You too.
We've been talking about mental health during this second pandemic holiday season, and COVID-19 has claimed more than 5 million lives globally. That means many families have an empty chair at the holiday table this year, including many families in our takeaway community of listeners.
Sam Nugent, calling from Malden, South Carolina. Differences for this year's Thanksgiving. Last year, my husband was alive, died from COVID in February. this year will be very difficult.
Pam, thank you for leaving that voicemail, and we are so sorry for your loss. Dr. Sonia Lott is a licensed psychologist specializing in prolonged grief, and she's here to help us through coping with grief and loss during the holidays. Dr. Lott, it is so great to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Melissa. I'm really grateful to be here to talk about such an important topic.
Let's just start with the ways that the holidays can be so difficult for so long, even if you didn't lose your loved one directly at the holiday. What is it about them that can trigger such grief?
The end of the year holiday season in particular is a time that we expect to be with our loved ones. And there's the expectation from society that we should be joyous and happy. And for so many people, that's just not what it's like, not just because of this being the second year of a pandemic. It's oftentimes for people that their grief is still unresolved from previous years, and the holidays heighten that. Or even if it is resolved, oftentimes when we gather together with that person not present, or people now with the pandemic, some family members have lost several members, you know, of their family, then it's, you know, difficult.
So in general, do we, I'm always sort of multiple minds, to be clear, not trained in any way as a therapist or psychologist. So I'm wondering, do we directly address it? Do you put up the photograph? Do you, you know, evoke the name, you know, when you're going around, you know, maybe during your Thanksgiving gratitude session? Or, you know, do you do the avoidance? Like, let's just pretend and not keep bringing up what might be painful. Is it, I'm just kind of wondering, what are the most adaptive ways for managing this?
There isn't just one way, one best way. It really depends on the individuals that then gather together. And Thanksgiving is around the corner now, but it's really helpful to have a conversation with family and friends that we're planning to gather with, or who this year we may be declining to gather with, about the best way to honor the loved one and to allow the sadness, you know, rather than try to avoid it. And also try to lean into moments of joy if they show up. You know, it can be both. But people's hearts know that the person isn't there. So we don't have to talk about it to know that's true. So it's better to find a way to allow what's already in your heart to show up.
I'm wondering if there is particular advice for children who may have lost caregivers, grandparents, aunties, uncles, maybe even their parents.
Melissa, that's a really difficult situation to have to try to manage. It depends so much on the age of the child, the personality of the child, you know, the age, how much they understand about what death is and what it means not to have the loved one there. If it's a parent, it may be very different than if it's an auntie or an uncle. But it's most important to try to find space as the adult in the room, if you will, to try to be present with where the child is and what the child needs. Try to have a conversation with the child in language that they understand, that's age appropriate, and allow them to be able to express their emotions, particularly their sadness.
I'm wondering if grief, both for children and adults, might show up as though it's something else, like anger or hyperactivity. Like, I'm wondering if there are ways that we can be sure we're recognizing when something is grief, even if it doesn't show up like tears.
We can't always know for sure. It's more common for males to express anger. We give men permission to do that more than we do women. But yeah, grief shows up in a lot of different ways. Emotionally, it can be anger, confusion, difficulty making decisions, sadness, guilt about perhaps if I would have noticed that he was more fatigued than he had been, or if I had noticed that she was having headaches frequently, then maybe I could have done something and maybe they wouldn't have died. There are many different ways that grief can show up emotionally, but it can also show up physically. Fatigue as a physical characteristic of some other illness that may lead to death, but it may be a part of a grief response. It can be headaches as a part of a grief response. So spiritually, you know, feeling hopeless and that there isn't a God if you believe there was one before, it can show up in a lot of different ways. And we can't always know as the individual experiencing it or as a friend or family member who's witnessing it. Even if we're sharing the same grief, we don't always recognize the different ways that it shows up.
I want to talk a little bit about the prolonged and maybe even delayed experiences of grief. My elder sister, with whom I'm very close, lost her husband years ago now. And it, you know, there are moments when I realize I've forgotten, like, oh, well, that happened years ago. But then it occurs to me, but no, but every Thanksgiving, every Christmas is still some moments without her beloved partner, father of her children. Are there ways that whether you are the person who's experienced the grief or if you are the beloved of someone experiencing the grief that is, you know, seemingly years ago, but still trying to hold space for it in a holiday setting?
Grief is lifelong. The sadness around the loved one no longer being here, wishing they hadn't died, and then really being reminded acutely of that during, you know, special events and holidays. And if it's not our immediate loss, you know, you're right, we do tend to forget that. But I think because we're going into the second holiday, end of the year holiday season in a pandemic, more of us are aware that many of us are grieving or still grieving. And just let the person know, I recognize that this might be a difficult time for you. I'm here for you if you are really emotionally available for them. You know, we're afraid of saying the wrong thing, but often acting as if what is not is more painful than actually saying, I don't know what to say, or I'm not sure how you're feeling, but I want you to know I'm aware that this might be a difficult time for you. So it's naming it and sort of giving the person permission to be where they are if they are, you know, particularly sad on that day. So it's really the naming that's most important, because people who are in grief sometimes very commonly feel like people are tired of hearing my grief. And if somebody is experiencing what we call prolonged grief, where it's been more than a year since the death of the loved one, but the grief still feels very acute and it's pretty persistent and interferes with the person's day-to-day functioning, that's what we refer to as prolonged grief disorder. And it's very common, especially with that situation, for people to feel like everybody else must be tired of my grief because I am.
A final question. For those who are facing this holiday, and maybe they don't want to be isolated, they don't want to be all alone, but they also don't necessarily, you know, maybe their appetite isn't back for eating a big meal, or they just don't want to manage all of the expectations of a holiday meal. Are there ways to be together without having to do it all? Ways to give oneself permission to be maybe a little bit more alone?
Yeah. I always tell individuals to, and again, Thanksgiving is upon us, but I tell individuals to not volunteer or say no if they typically are the person who does the big holiday meal, if that's the case, to give themselves a respite this year if they're feeling really tender, or especially if this is the first Thanksgiving or first Christmas season without the loved one. Try to give yourself permission to not be the host this year. That's the first thing. Because of the pandemic, we aren't traveling as much. So if you typically would get on a plane to go across from East Coast to West Coast or something, you know, far away, don't do that this year. The situation with the pandemic sort of offers a way to say no when you may have felt guilty or perhaps would have felt guilty to have done that pre-COVID. And the other thing is, I tell individuals, don't decline an invitation until it's time to leave your home, to go wherever you're heading or planning to go. You may change your mind. If you say no, you close the door too soon, you may change your mind. Something may shift for you so that that day when you're getting dressed, you may decide that you are up for it. You can always leave early, you know, but make the decision that's going to serve your highest good when it's time to put that plan in action.
Dr. Sonia Lott is a licensed psychologist specializing in grief. Thank you so much for joining us.
My joy. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Europe has once again become the global epicenter of the pandemic. In an interview with the BBC, WHO Europe director said he was, quote, very worried about the spread of COVID-19 across Europe, noting that as many as another 500,000 people could die by March. In response, some European governments have initiated new COVID restrictions, including lockdowns for the unvaccinated. For more on this, we're joined now by Yasmin Serhan, writer, staff writer for The Atlantic. Yasmin, always great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
So what is behind this latest surge in Europe?
So there are a lot of factors, but I think the banner one, which we've been talking about a lot in recent days across the continent, has been low vaccination rates. Despite the fact that Europe is home to many vaccine-rich countries, it nonetheless has seen pretty uneven vaccination coverage between countries. So, you know, some like Portugal and Spain and Ireland have vaccination rates as high as 80 and even close to 90%. But elsewhere in Germany and Austria, for example, it's still in the mid to high 60s. And in other places, it's even lower. And I think what we're seeing across Europe is that even in countries with really like wide vaccination coverage, those small pockets of unvaccinated people, even if they're, you know, 1 to 2 million, as is the case in Austria, those groups can drive a lot of transmission. And what we're increasingly seeing that's worrying, and I think Austria is kind of the key example here because they're the ones that have taken the most tough restrictions so far, is that we're seeing intensive care units suddenly reach capacity and hospitals are once again coming under renewed strain, which has caused a lot of governments, as you just mentioned, to kind of take a step back and reconsider what do we need to do now, especially as we head into the winter when we anticipate that, you know, the more time we spend indoors, the more transmission we might see.
All right, let's talk about the Austrian case for a bit, because in some ways, I guess I've been a bit surprised. Perhaps this is my having not actually traveled to Austria, but just having sort of a sense of it as a sort of rule following nation. I was a bit surprised to find that vaccination rates are still under 70% and that there is, you know, these massive demonstrations against the government's current plan for a 20-day lockdown for all and then a, you know, lockdown for the unvaccinated thereafter.
Yeah, I mean, Austria really did, I think, surprise a lot of people, not just you, last week when they announced that they were going to implement a lockdown just for the unvaccinated population. Now, that's not a small population. In Austria's case, unfortunately, that's about a third of the country, roughly 2 million people, who were basically told that they should stay home unless undergoing sort of basic essential needs, such as going to work or grocery shopping or going out and getting vaccinated. Those were kind of the stipulations. And that didn't apply to people who had already recently recovered from COVID or for folks under the age of 12. So that was a pretty big step. I think that's the only kind of, you know, unvaccinated lockdown that we've seen, certainly in Europe. And ultimately, even that wasn't enough. I think, you know, cases were climbing at such a high rate and ICUs were coming under such strain that the Austrian government ended up saying at the end of the week, actually, we need to go into lockdown for everybody. And that's what they've done. So as of this week, Austria is in a full shutdown for about 20 days, at which point they're hoping they can end that and then just continue with their unvaccinated lockdown. But they're taking vaccination really seriously now. They really see it as their way out of the pandemic. So as of February of next year, they're going to be mandating vaccinations. That's the first vaccine mandate that I believe we've seen, certainly in Western Europe. And yeah, it's a pretty big deal. And as you've mentioned, it's led to a lot of protests.
So, Yasmin, with these, the surge in cases, are we also seeing a surge in deaths? Because presumably some of these cases are among the vaccinated. And so while they may be COVID positive, we'd be expecting, right, to have less serious manifestations of the illness.
Yeah, you're exactly right there. I mean, I think vaccinations have meant that we are not seeing the same rates of hospitalization and mortality that we've seen earlier when Europe was at the epicenter of the pandemic previously. So that's the good news. But I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing, this is certainly the case in Austria, and I think it's a trend that we're seeing elsewhere, is that the majority of people who are in the intensive care right now are unvaccinated. So that's the real concern here, that we're going to have a lot of people who don't have that protection, who end up in hospital, and who therefore are at higher risk of dying. And I think that's the other concern too, is that, you know, the more cases we have, the more hospitalizations we have, the higher, unfortunately, the higher death rate that we're likely to see. And indeed, that's the risk that the WHO flagged to Europe. I believe they said that Europe is the world's only region with coronavirus deaths on the rise, with a 5% jump since earlier this month. And they even warned that, you know, the continent could see as many as 500,000 more deaths by March unless urgent action is taken. So I think what the biggest lesson to me, at least, that we're kind of seeing in Europe, and which, you know, other countries like the United States would be right, I think, to kind of look at, is that, you know, even if you have a widely vaccinated population, yes, that's going to help you. That's hopefully going to keep deaths down, certainly compared to what we've seen previously in this pandemic. But it's not enough that we actually, you know, especially as the winter sets in, especially as we're dealing with a more transmissible Delta, that perhaps other measures need to be taken as well. And those could be measures such as masks, but they can be, you know, in some cases, even more intense measures like partial lockdowns, full lockdowns.
Let me just ask, I am a bit surprised to discover that it is Europe at the center when, you know, because if you look at the global map of vaccinations, it is the continent of Africa that kind of stands out as having the fewest doses of vaccine, again, across this enormous continent. Now, is that simply because we don't know about those cases, or is there something different happening on the continent of Africa than in the nations of Europe?
I don't follow Africa as closely, so I can't really speak to what's kind of different there versus Europe. But I think what I can say about Europe generally is that one of the things that I think is perhaps contributing to the rise in cases that we're seeing is that obviously the continent of Europe is incredibly vaccine rich, many of the countries having, you know, enough to supply their populations and then some. What we saw during the summer was that because of the vaccination and because of, you know, temperatures rising, people mingling more outdoors, a lot of European countries lifted their restrictions. And, you know, I'm talking to you from Britain, which as of now has virtually no restrictions in place, you know, and that means, you know, there's no mandate to wear masks, no social distancing, businesses are back up and running. So I think that's part of at least how I'm understanding this, that we've kind of entered a phase where we really did sort of take off all the restrictions. And whilst we did do a lot of vaccination and that was great, I think what we're dealing now is a confluence of a couple of things. On the one hand, temperatures are dropping. So people are going back indoors. We know that when people are back indoors, if they're not wearing masks, transmission is more likely. But also we're seeing waning immunity. That's why we're seeing these booster campaigns going full speed ahead. I know here in Britain, they're offering boosters to people over the age of 40. I know that boosters are now being rolled out across the continent as well. So that's one challenge. But then, I mean, the third challenge, and I'll go back to it, is the fact that, you know, there are large pockets of various populations across Europe that haven't been vaccinated yet. And part of that comes down to the fact that, you know, that there are far right parties, and this is certainly the case in Austria, that have been very sort of vaccine skeptic and anti-lockdown. But also, I think it fundamentally comes down to distrust.
Yasmin Sirhan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for...
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Having me.
Back with The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Heading into the holiday season, nearly 60% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated. Good job, folks. And almost 70% have received at least one dose. But still, according to the CDC, U.S. COVID infections were up sharply this past week. And while European governments are responding with strict restrictions and new quarantine measures, many American states continue to follow a far more libertarian pathway. For example, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called a special legislative session to move new rules against COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Now, those who resist vaccine mandates typically cite medical choice and freedom. Here at The Takeaway, we were curious about the history of these arguments and the way that they're connected to American identity. So we called up this guy.
My name is Lewis Grossman. I'm the author of Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America.
Now, I asked Grossman to walk us through the history of therapeutic choice.
So when I conceived of this book, I was focusing not so much on freedom from compulsion, which is one of the big issues now, obviously, with mandatory vaccination, so much as freedom to obtain the treatments that you want without the government interfering in those choices. Now, this impulse has always overlapped significantly, organizationally, ideologically, with freedom from compulsion. So this is a broader issue than resistance to mandatory medication, but it does include resistance to mandatory medication.
Okay, so I feel like I need to back up a little bit, maybe to even more foundational concept here of freedom. And you write about a version of Jacksonian democracy that lays out four specific freedoms: freedom of conscience, freedom of person, freedom of business, and also kind of a universal equal freedom. So can you kind of walk us through how those ideas of freedom are connected back to this question of therapeutic or medical freedom?
So modern people, when they enter into the world of freedom of therapeutic choice, tend to focus on bodily freedom. This is largely an outgrowth of the early 1970s when Roe v. Wade and right to choose were the dominant strains of medical freedom discussions in the United States. But in fact, even though bodily freedom has always been an important strain of this ideology, there are also other very important ones, including economic freedom, which I can say more about, religious freedom, which I can also say more about, and freedom of inquiry. Each of those opens up a door into an interesting discussion. But I will mention that if you look at medical freedom rhetoric today in the context of COVID, you hear all four of these freedom themes in connection with freedom of therapeutic choice. And what's interesting is that until fairly recently in history, pretty much the mid-20th century, testimonials and anecdotes were the basis upon which everybody decided whether medicines were effective or not. With the rise of the randomized controlled trial in the mid-20th century, the medical establishment now has an incredibly different approach to assessing efficacy. And that approach is in many ways in tension with the notion of trial and error and free, unrestricted, unregulated choice. Because, of course, in a randomized controlled trial, first of all, you are not even being told which thing you're getting. You might be getting the drug, but you might also be getting a sugar pill, and you don't even know which one you're getting. But what's interesting in addition is that the notion of unrestricted societal experimentation with a drug is in tension with that mission of doing randomized controlled trials, because any person who's desperately ill, who has a choice between either entering a randomly controlled trial where there's a 50% chance they're going to get a sugar pill, and on the other hand, to a situation where they know they're getting the drug, which may give them some hope, they're going to turn toward that latter option and not participate in clinical trials.
Let's also talk for just a moment, and then I do want to bring it directly to the question of vaccine hesitancy. But I want to connect not only these freedoms, but also the question of populism and of trust. And I think the trust piece that you begin to articulate, even with the notion of the randomized trials and the idea that, well, I'd have to trust those who are making the choices, trust that it is randomized, trust that that the pharmaceutical companies aren't going to harm me with the active ingredient, right? There's all of these various layers of trust. And as you wrote about the ways that a deterioration of trust had been associated with, for example, getting rid of medical licenses just in the ramp up to the Civil War, it occurred to me that we are also in this moment of a reduction of trust in so many collective institutions.
Yes, I mean, I think that's one of the defining features of our age is Americans' lack of trust, sometimes fading over into actual paranoia about our establishment institutions, whether it's the government or establishment science and medicine or big business or the media. And a lot of people look at the current state of America with respect to trust and think that we are going off the rails. But one of the basic themes of my book is that we're actually reverting to our norm. America has been distrustful of establishment institutions throughout most of its history. The one striking exception is a time I remember and in which my parents and grandparents experienced more directly than I did, a time in the mid-20th century when America was flush with pride in its scientific achievements and in the victory of World War II, and with scientific and medical progress such as the polio vaccine. And the 1970s really represented a point in time in which this trust disintegrated in a bipartisan way. And we've kind of been in this situation ever since.
So I think you've in many ways hit on one of the challenging sort of spaces I feel like even I occupy and so many folks who I know, which is it's almost an inversion ideologically around, look, just trust the government, just trust the government and do what the government says to do by so many folks who are my progressive and liberal friends who typically say, hey, don't trust the government. Don't just do what the government tells you to do. And I guess I'm a little surprised by how the pandemic has left us mapping ideologically. Actually, it seems like in reverse to what has typically been how we thought, at least maybe since that 1970s moment, about trust in government.
I am a little bit surprised by it, too. There have been other times in American history where attitudes toward medical freedom have mapped onto political parties. For example, the early 19th century, which you mentioned, when medical freedom activists were associated very much with the Jacksonian Democrats. What we see now is quite different from the 70s, as you alluded to, because even before the 1970s, you had right-wing conspiracy theorists and skepticism about establishment institutions. What you got in the 1970s was a mainstreaming and a bipartisan aspect to this. And, you know, the left is not immune at all from distrusting establishment institutions, as you mentioned. And there actually is a surprising level of trust from the progressive side of the political spectrum, whereas the mistrust from the conservative side of the political spectrum, I don't really find surprising. I find it typical because there has been both a right side and a left side distrust for a long time in American political thought.
So the text is largely about political thought, about the ways that we've wrestled with these big questions. But But in terms of wrestling with these big questions, I mean, there are structures and systems that have, sort of across the American narrative, helped us to adjudicate these by literally adjudicating them and determining what constitutes constitutional action on the part of the government and what does not. Based on what you understand about how these debates have played out and also what the jurisprudence is, are the current mandates from the Biden administration constitutional?
The technical question that the courts are confronting now with respect to the Biden mandates are actually more a question of administrative law and statutory interpretation than they are of constitutional law. I mean, constitutional issues are always hanging out there as a potential issue, but especially when we're talking now about the OSHA mandate for workplaces of more than 100 people, the main line of attack on that mandate is that it is exceeding OSHA's authority to issue a mandate of that type. And so you may see decisions first coming out with respect to that are actually quite technical, rather than really embracing the deep philosophical issues I discuss in my book.
Are we still in an infancy around medicine that maybe we don't realize that we still are in? So I guess I'm asking, when we're looking at vaccines, whether it is the COVID vaccine or medical trials for other kinds of medications, I guess I have a pretty robust trust in the scientific process. And I'm concerned that maybe that is misplaced and simply socio-historical, and that in 50 years, it will be obvious that all of this was poorly placed trust in medicine.
It is worth noting that modern medical science has not won the fight, if you will. There are whole disease areas where they have not come up with solutions. And in addition to that, even when it comes to the most effective therapies, there are invariably risks involved and invariably not perfect efficacy. And anybody who's inclined to be skeptical of modern medicine can look at that unavoidable uncertainty and measure it in a way that reinforces their own skepticism about modern medicine.
Are pandemics different than cancer relative to sort of the limits of our own freedom for making choices about how we're going to intervene?
Well, contagious diseases raise different issues, because if you're talking about a disease that is threatening your own life, but not threatening the life of those around you, that is obviously a very different question than a disease where if you acquire the disease, you can also infect other people. And I'd also like to point out, by the way, that for all the news print that the vaccine resistors are getting, we today are in a situation where, I forget the exact number, but 70%, 75% of Americans have taken the vaccine. And so I don't think that the level of vaccine skepticism we're seeing with respect to COVID is necessarily all that different from the level of vaccine skepticism we saw 100 years ago.
I suspect, there was certainly this feeling of, oh, surely when it's available, everyone will want to take it. But, it's a little bit of a misplaced anxiety. I feel like when you look at the map, it's, the global mapping of COVID vaccines, it's pretty clear the U.S. is near the top. there are some nations where one has fewer than the four freedoms, where we have higher vaccination levels. But the real question is parts of the world where the vaccine is simply unavailable. And no matter what choices people want to make, they're unable to make those choices.
Now, it is interesting to contrast the COVID vaccine with, for example, the polio vaccine. The polio vaccine, when it was rolled out in the 1950s, invented by Jonas Salk, who became a national hero, there was very, very widespread celebration and uptake of that vaccine. Parents around the country willingly rolled up their children's sleeves to participate not just in receiving the approved vaccine, but actually participating in clinical trials in the first place. Now we're obviously in a different place, but it's also important to recognize certain differences between the situations. One of them is that the victims of polio were most prominently children, whereas many of the victims of COVID are elderly people and people with other conditions that are dying quietly behind closed doors and maybe are not the same, you know, the same kind of poster children, literally, as the polio poster children were. Second, I heard somebody interviewed recently who said, well, polio was almost completely effective, whereas this is only 70% effective. And Americans are really bad at risk assessment. But, you know, that is a difference that people can grasp onto, especially when you add to the fact that everyone knew if they got polio, they were facing dire, dire circumstances. Whereas in COVID, especially the younger population knows that if they get COVID, they may suffer very few personal consequences at all. And therefore, what you have to do is appeal to people's altruism and devotion to community health. And America's never been great at that.
Is there a way to engage some of these big issues around populism, around trust, around freedom, to make us better at exactly that?
Yeah, I'm sad to say that I'm pretty pessimistic about this issue. Let's start by saying that public health officials themselves have to become better at communicating about risk and uncertainty in a way that they can preserve the public's trust rather than invite skepticism every time anything they say doesn't turn out to be exactly what happens. But I feel like our media environment today is so divided, and people are getting their version of the truth from their own sources. And by the way, this isn't new in America either. This was newspapers in 1820, 1830. They were completely partisan. But I don't know exactly how this country overcomes this divide based on mistrust when everybody is getting their news from sources that are largely kind of just reinforcing their own prior beliefs.
That was Lewis Grossman, author of Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America. Before we go, we want to leave you with a transformative takeaway. Bob Vogelbaugh is known as Mr. Thanksgiving in his hometown of Moline, Illinois. For 51 years, he's been feeding thousands of people each Thanksgiving. Back in 1970, when Bob owned a grocery store, he learned that one of his elderly customers would be alone for Thanksgiving. Well, that didn't sit well with Bob, so he called together several of his other senior customers as well, and they transformed the back room of his grocery store into a spot for Thanksgiving dinner. He's been hosting Thanksgiving for families ever since. Now, Bob no longer owns his grocery store, but that's okay, because the dinners have gotten so big, they're now hosted at the local mall. Bob's not doing all the cooking alone, but he is still involved with raising the money and organizing the community to make it happen. And he didn't stop in the pandemic. Last year, Mr. Thanksgiving hosted a drive-up service and handed out more than 3,000 meals. They plan on doing the same this year. Bob Vogelbaugh, your model of generosity, kindness, and perseverance is the transformative takeaway we all need at this time of year. Now, if you know someone doing transformative work in your community, please call us and let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. Come on back tomorrow. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.